Okay, so I got a bunch of requests for more safer work content on my subreddit, audio content. Happy to provide that. Only problem is I can only talk for so long, and I figured just a bunch of rambles would be something that I couldn't keep up with, so I came up with an idea. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Project Gutenberg, but basically it's this online website. It's www.gutenberg.org, where you can go and all of these books are out of copyright. So I figured I could just read my fucking way through some of these books. And that's just a world amount of content. That's just like so much fucking stuff. So I peeked around and I found one that tickled my fancy. Found it under the humor section. It is called Grim Tales Made Gay by Guy Wetmore Carroll. And it says the release date was October 13th, 2007. So that's when it must have went out of copyright. So I'm going to read some of these stories. I'm going to start with How the Babes in the Wood Showed They Couldn't Be Beaten. Okay. A man of kind and noble mind was H. Gustav Hyde. 'Twas would be amiss to add to this at present, for he died in full possession of his senses the day before my tale commences. One half his gold, his four-year-old son Paul was known. Son Paul was known to win, and Beatrix, whose age was six, for all the rest came in. Perceiving which, their uncle Ben did a thing that people said was splendid, for by the hand he took them, and remarked in accent smooth, "One thing I ask, be mine the task these stricken babies to soothe. My country home is really charming. I'll teach them all the joys of farming." When Halkin weak, they finished his creek and watched him do the chores, and haylofts hid and shouting slid down sloping cellar doors. Because this life to bliss was equal, the more distressing is the sequel. Concealing guile behind a smile, he took them to a wood, and with severe and most austere injunctions to be good, he left them seated on a gateway and took his own departure straight away. There's illustrations here too. I'll link it so you guys can see. Though much afraid, the children stayed from 10 till nearly 8. At times they wept, at times they slept, but never left the gate. Until the swift suspicion crossed him that Uncle Benjamin had lost them. And quite unnerved, young Paul observed, "It's like a dreadful dream, and Uncle Ben has fallen 10% in my esteem. Not only did he first usurp us, but now he's left us here on purpose. For countless years their childish fears have made the reader pale. For countless years the public's tears have started at the tale. For countless years much detestation has been expressed for their relation. So draw a veil across the dale where stood that ghastly gate. No need to tell, you know full well what was their touching fate. And now, with leaves in each dead little breast, was covered by a robin redbreast. But when they found them on the ground, though their life had ceased, quite near to Paul, they lay a small white paper nearly creased. Because of lack of any merit, behind it ran, we disinherit. The moral. If you deeply long to punish one who you've done wrong, though in your life time you may fail, where there's a will, there is a way. All right, that was, again, How the Babes in the Wood Showed They Couldn't Be Beaten. I think I'm also going to read How Fair Cinderella Disposed of Her Shoe. the Venus Girls in 40 States were Glendon and Gladys Glades. Gladys Glades. The Venus Girls in 40 States were Glendolyn and Gladys Gates. They warbled slightly off the air romantic German songs, and each of them upon her hair employed the curling tongs, and each with ardor most intense her buxom figure laced, until her willful want of sense procured a woeful waste, for bound to marry titled mates were Glendolyn and Gladys Gates. Yet truth to tell, the swains were few of Gwendolyn and Gladys too. So morning, afternoon, and night upon their sister they were wont to vent their selfish sprite. This is a tongue twister, guys. Upon their sister they were wont to vent their selfish spite, and in the rudest way, for though her name was Leonor, that's neither there nor here, they called her Cinderella, for the kitchen was her sphere, save when the hair she had to do of Gwendolyn and Gladys too. I don't know if it's Gladys or Gladys. Gladys? I don't know. Each night to dances and to fetes went Gwendolyn and Gladys Getz, and Cinderella watched them go in silks and satins clad. A prince invited them, and so they put on all they had. But one fine night, as all alone she watched the flames leap higher, a small and stooping fairy crone stepped nimbly by the fire. She said, "The pride upon me grates of Gwendolyn and Gladys Gates." All now, she added with a frown, call Gwendolyn and Gladys down. And ere your fingers you could snap, there stood before the door no paltry hired horse and trap, oh no, a coach and four. And Cinderella fitted out, regardless of expense, made both her sisters look about like 35, 37 cents. The prince with one look at her gown turned Gwendolyn and Gladys down. Wallflowers, when thus compared to her, but Gwendolyn and Gladys were. The prince but gave them glances hard, no gracious words he said. He scratched their names from off his card and wrote down hers instead. And where he would bestow his hand, he showed them a trice by handing her the kisses and each of them an ice. In sudden need of fire and fur, both Gwendolyn and Gladys were. At 10 o'clock, in discontent, both Gwendolyn and Gladys went. Their sister stayed till after 2, and when with joy sincere, the prince obtained a crystal shoe by way of souvenir, upon the bridal path he cried, "We'll reign together. Since I love you, you must be my bride." He was no slouch, that prince, and into sudden languishment both Gwendolyn and Gladys went. The moral? All the girls on earth exaggerate their proper worth. They think the very shoes they wear are worth the average millionaire, whereas few pairs in any town can be sold for half a crown. I don't think I'm going to edit this that much. Y'all can deal with my stumbling and mumbling over words. Okay, how about... Little Red Riding Hood came to be eating. How Little Red Riding Hood came to be eating. That sounds like fun. Okay. Most worthy of praise were the virtuous ways of Little Red Riding Hood's ma, and no one was ever more cautious and clever than Little Red Riding Hood's pa. They never misled for what they said, and would frequently say what they meant. and the way she should go, they were careful to show, and the way they showed her, she went. For obedience, she was effusively thanked, and for anything else, she was carefully spanked. Oh, man. Thus, isn't strange that Red Riding Hood's range of virtues steadily grew, that soon she won prizes of different sizes and gold and compliments, too. And encomiums? I don't know that word. Let me look it up. Hold on. Let's listen to Google say it.
Encomium.
Encomium. A speech or piece of writing that praises someone or something highly. Okay. And golden encomiums, too. Is that how she was saying it?
Encomium.
Comium. Encomium. Okay. And golden encomiums, too. As a general rule, she was head of her school, and at 6 she was notably smart, that they gave her a check for reciting the wreck of the Hesperus wholly by heart. And you all will applaud her the more, I am sure, when I add that this money she gave to the poor. Aww. At 11, this lass had a Sunday school class. At 12, she wrote a volume of verse. At 13, she was yearning for glory and learning to be a professional nurse. To a glorious height, the young paragon might have grown if not nipped in the bud. But the following year struck her smiling career with a dull and sickening thud. In parentheses here it says, I have shed a great tear at the thought of her pain and must copy my manuscript over again. Okay. Not dreaming of harm, one day on her arm a basket she hung. It was filled with jellies and ices and gruel and spices and chicken legs carefully grilled and savory stew, a novel or two she persuaded a neighbor to loan, and a hot water can and a Japanese fan and a bottle of eau de cologne, and the rest of the things that your family fill your room with, whatever your chance to be ill. Okay, moving on. She expected to find her decrepit but kind old grandmother waiting her call, but the visage that met her completely upset her. It wasn't familiar at all. With a whitening cheek, she started to speak, but her peril she instantly saw. Her grandma had fled, and she tackled instead for merciless paws and maw. When the neighbors came running, the wolf to subdue, he was licking his chops in Red Riding Hood's too. At this terrible tale, some readers will pale, and others with horror grow dumb. Yet it was better. I fear he should get her. I just think what she might have... Let's go back to the top. At this terrible tale, some readers will pale, and others with horror grow dumb. And yet it was better. I fear he should get her. Just think of what she might have become. For an infant so keen, might a future have been a woman of awful renown, who carried on fights for her feminine rights as the mayor of an Arkansas town. She might have continued the crime of her teens and come to write first for the big magazines. The moral. There's nothing much glamour than children whose talents appall. One much prefers those who are dumber, but as for the paragons small, if a swallow cannot make a summer, it can bring on a summery fall. Yeah, this book is full of some great virtues. And okay. Another one. Okay, this is a word. I'm pretty sure I know what it is. Let me just Google it real quick. Yeah, okay. How the fatuous wish of a peasant came true. Let's just make sure Google tells me I'm saying it right. I think it's fatuous.
Fatuous.
Fatuous. Oh my god, I'm a fucking idiot.
Ugh. Fatuous.
Fatuous. Fatuous. Not fascist. Fatuous. Fatuous. Means silly and pointless. So, how the fatuous wish of a pheasant. Pheasant? wishes of pheasants are never fatuous. No, is it pheasant or peasant? When I first read this, I thought it was peasant. Yeah, I think it's peasant. There's no H in there. It's peasant. Okay. How the fascist wish of a peasant came true. Moving on. Okay. An excellent peasant of character, pleasant, once lived in a hut with his wife. He was cheerful and docile, but such an old fossil you wouldn't meet twice in your life. His notions were all without reason or rhyme, such dullness in anyone else were a crime, but the folly pig-headed to which he was wedded was so deep embedded it touched the sublime. He frequently stated such quite antiquated and singular doctrines as these. Do good unto others, all men are your brothers. Of course he forgot the Chinese. He said that all men were made equal and free. That's true if they were born on our side of the sea. The truth should be spoken and pledges unbroken. Now where by that token would most of us be? One day at his pottage he ate in his cottage. A fairy stepped up onto the door. Upon it she hammered and meekly she stammered, a morsel of food I implore. He gave her sardines and a biscuit or two, and all she said in reply, when her luncheon was through, in return for these dishes of bread and of fishes, the first of your wishes I'll make come true. That nincompoop peasant accepted the present, as most of us probably would, and thanking her bounty to turn to account, he said, now I'll do something good. I won't ask a thing for myself or my wife, but I'll make all my neighbors with happiness rife. Whatever their conditions, henceforth physicians and impositions they're rid of for life. These very words energetic, the fairy's prophetic announcement brought instantly true. With singular quickness, each victim of sickness was made better. Was made over better than new. And people who formerly thought they were doomed with almost obstreperous? Obstreperous. This is like a words lesson. Alright, that one means noisy and difficult to control. Obstreperous?
Obstreperous.
I think I said that right the first time, but I'm not entirely sure. Moving on. Again, it means noisy and difficult to control. Obstreperous. With almost obstreperous, healthiness bloomed, and each with some platitude teeming with gratitude for the new attitude life had assumed. Our friend's satisfaction concerning his action was keen but exceedingly brief. The wrathful condition of every physician in town was surpassing belief. Professional nurses were plunged in despair, and chemists shook passionate fists in the air. They called at his dwelling with violence swelling. His greeted repelling was arrogant stare. They beat and they battered, they slammed and they shattered, and did him such serious harm that after their labors, his wife told the neighbors they'd cause her excessive alarm. Then they set to work on his various ills and piled him with liniments, powders, and pills, and charged him so dearly that all of them nearly made double the yearly amount of their bill. I'm interested in the moral in this one. Okay, so here it is. The moral by the tale is taught. The wish is father to the thought. We oftentimes escape the worst, but if the thinking part comes first. The wish is father to the thought. Okay. I'm going to read it again. The wish is the father to the thought. We'd oftentimes escape the worst, but the thinking part came first. No. If the thinking part came first. One more time. I won't fuck it up this time. The wish is father to the thought. We'd oftentimes escape the worst if but the thinking part came first. Oh, gosh. I didn't know this was going to be so difficult. I should have, but I didn't. Rolling right along. Okay, this one's called How Hoppo My Thumb Got Rid of an Onus. Okay. Whew. I'm not sweating, but I feel like I should be. A worthy couple, man and wife, dragged on a discontented life. The reason I should state that it was destitute of joys was that they had a dozen boys to feed and educate, and nothing such patient demands as having 12 boys on your hands. Oh. For 20 years, they tried their best to keep those urchins neatly dressed and teach them to be good, but so much labor it involved that in the end, they both resolved to lose them in a wood. Though nothing apparent annoys like heartlessly losing his boys. Oh no! I think there's French in the there's French in this one. I think that's what it is. Okay. I'm gonna try it. Oh, okay. So when their sons had gone to bed, though bitter tears the couple shed, they'd laid their little plan. Okay. Fought Ben K. Sassafase. Quand même? The woman said. Sure. Je en suis tout blême. Sa colle? Observe the man. Mais sa côté que c'est gosses. Fitches. Ben quoi. But keeps on her chest. I'm sorry. I was having trouble with English, and then I'm only gonna assume this is French because it looks French to me. But it could be something fucking else. Oh my god. Okay. Here we go. I have quite omitted to explain they were natives of Terrain. Now I'm going to look where Terrain is from. Is that a real place? Terrain? Does anybody know? Oh, it is a real place. Guess what? It is French. I'm not an idiot. Okay. Cool. It's landlocked, France. Okay. I've quite omitted to explain they were natives of Terrain. I see I must translate. Thank God. Of course it must be done and still your wife. Of course it must be done and still, the wife remarked. It makes me ill. You bet, replied her mate. But we've both of us counted the cost and the kids simply have to be lost. But while they applauded every word, the youngest of the urchins heard and winked the other eye. His height was only 2'3", I might remark in passing. He was little, but oh my. He added, I'd better keep my mum. He was foxy. Was hop-o-my-thumb. They took the boys into the woods and lost them as they said they should. And came back in silence back. Alas for them, hop up my hum. At every step had dropped a crumb, and so retraced the track. While parents sat mourning their fate, he led the boys in at the gate. He placed his hand upon his heart and said, "You think you're awfully smart, but I have foiled you thus." His parents humbly bent the knee and meekly said, "HOMT, you're one too much for us." And both of them solemnly swore, "We won't never do so no more." All right, let's see the moral here. Okay. While I do not endeavor to condone the plot, I still maintain that one should have no chance of being foiled and having one's arrangements spoiled by one's ingenious son. If you turn down your children with pain, take care they don't turn up again. Okay, let me see. This is round and about to be 30 minutes, so maybe two more. This one is how the helpmate of Bluebeard made free with a door. He stole a door? Okay. A maiden from Bosphorus, with eyes as bright as phosphorus, once wed the wealthy bailiff on the caliph of Calate. Though diligent and zealous, he became a slave to jealousy. Considering her beauty, 'twas his duty to be that. When business would necessitate a journey, he would hesitate, but fearing to disgust her, he would just trust her with his keys. He would trust her with his keys, not distrust. Remarking her prayerfully, "I beg you'll use them carefully. Don't look what I deposit in that closet, if you please." It may be mentioned casually that blue as lapis lazuli, he dyed his hair, his lashes, his mustaches, and his beard. And just because he did it, he aroused his wife's timidity. Her terror she dissembled, but she trembled when he neared. This feeling in slabberous soon made her most lugubrious, and bitterly she missed her elder sister, Mary Ann. She asked if she might write her to come down and spend a night or two. Her husband answered rightly and politely, "Yes, you can." Bluebeard, the following morning, his jealous feeling swallowing, packed all his clothes together in a leather, bound valise, and feigning reprehensively, he started out ostensibly by traveling to learn a bit of Smyrna and Greece. His wife made but a cursory inspection of the kitchen. The kitchen and the airy little dairy were a bore, as well as bigger scanty rooms and billard bath and anterooms, but not that interdicted and restricted little door. For all her curiosity awakened by the closet he so carefully had hidden and forbidden her to see, this damsel disobedient did something inexpedient, and in the keyhole tiny turned the shiny little key. Then started back impulsively and shrieked aloud convulsively. Three heads of girls he'd wed and beheaded met her eye. And turning around, much terrified, her darkest fears were verified. For Bluebeard stood behind her, come to find her on the sly. Perceiving she was fated too, but soon decapitated too, she telegraphed her brothers and some others what she feared. and Sister Anne looked out for them in readiness to shout for them whenever in the distance with assistance they appeared. But only from her battlement she saw some dust that cattle meant the ordinary story isn't gory but a jest. But here's the truth unqualified. Her husband wasn't mollified. Her head is in his bloody little study with the rest. The moral. Wives, we must allow who their husband will not bow. A stern and dreadful lesson learn when as you've read their cut in turn. Okay. I think I said one more. Okay, one more. Hiram Bostilts held out in vain for bonus. In Germany, there lived an earl who had a charming niece and never gave the timid girl a single moment of peace. Whatever low and menial task his fancy fitted through, he did not hesitate to ask that shrieking child to do. I see with truly honest shame you are blushing, and I do not blame you. A tale like these, the feeling softens and brings the tears as does to orphans. She had to wash the windows and scrub. She had to scrub the floors. She had to lend a willing hand to 50 other chores. She gave the dog his exercise. She read the earl the news. She ironed all his evening ties and polished off his shoes. She cleaned the tins that filled the dairy. She cut the claws of the canary. And then at night, in manner winsome, when coal was wanted, carried in some. But though these tasks were quite enough, he thought them all too few. And so her uncle, rude and rough, invented something new. He took her to a little room, her willingness to tax, and pointed out a broken loom and half a ton of flax. Observing, spin 6 pairs of trousers, his haughty manner seemed to rouse hers. She met his scornful gaze proudly, and for an answer, whistled loudly. But when the earl went down the stairs, she yielded to her fears, gave way at last to grim despair and melting into tears. When suddenly from out the wall, as if he felt at home, there pounced a singularly small and much disordered gnome. He smiled a smile extremely vapid and set to work in a fashion rapid. No time for resting, he deducted, as soon as the trousers were constructed. The girl observed, "How very nice to help me out in this way." The gnome replied, "A certain price, of course, you'll have to pay. I'll call tomorrow afternoon my due reward to claim, and then you'll sing another tune unless you know my name." He indicated with a gesture the pile of newly fashioned vesture, his eyes on hers a moment centered, and then he went as he had entered. As by this tale you've been grieved and heartedly distressed, kind sir, you will be much relieved to know his name she guessed. But if I do not tell the same, pray count if it is not a crime. I've tried my best, and for that name I can't find any rhyme. Yet spare me from remarks injurious. I will not leave you foiled and furious. If something must proclaim the answer, and I cannot, the title can, sir. All right, our very last moral. All said and done. There's nothing new beneath the sun, and many times before, a title was incapacity's requital? Requital? Requital. Oh my gosh. I think it's requital. Come on, Gooks. Why Do I not have the... There it is. Requital. Requital? Requital? Requital?
Requital.
Requital. Okay. Requital. All right. That is quite a few of these Grimm's Gay Tales. What was it? Grim Tales Made Gay by Guy. And there are... Oh, I made it. Oh, gosh. That's maybe a third of them. So, get two more audios out of this, and then I'll find another one at Gutenberg. If you guys like this, let me know. Bye.